Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts, discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. As you know, Robert Greene is not just one of my writing heroes and one of my mentors, but a guiding and shaping force in my life. And yet, for as long as I've known Robert, and as much as an influence that he's had in my life, I actually haven't spent that much time with him. Early on in our relationship, my job was to drop off a stack of papers or a book at his house, or to talk to him on the phone for 30 minutes while he gave me instructions. And of course, we've had dinner and lunches and stuff before, but he spends a lot of time doing what he does. And I've always felt weird imposing on that or interrupting it. And so today's episode is a result of actually, I think, the most time that I've ever spent with Robert Greene, and certainly the most time my family has spent with Robert Greene. Robert Greene came out at the end of December to see me and my kids and my wife. He stayed at my house here in Texas. And one of the reasons he came out is he was signing a bunch of copies of his books so we could sell them at the Painted Porch bookstore, which you can check out at thepaintedporch.com. And then he also came out, we were recording a podcast with a couple of different mutual friends, which you might have seen on my social media. And then he and I wanted to record an episode of the podcast. So I got to sit down and interview Robert Greene, which I've had the privilege of doing, I think, 3 times in the last year. And so, I don't know, it was a wonderful trip. I got to have meals with Robert, got to socialize with Robert, I got to give him a tour of the farm. He got to meet my donkeys. And we got to just talk a bunch. And he bought some wonderful dinosaurs for my boys and some wonderful gluten-free bread that he brought with him. And I really, really had an amazing time. And I felt so grateful to be graced with his presence. And then I felt extra guilty on the way home because he had a hellish return trip, not just because traveling during COVID is stressful, but then there was a delayed flight and a delayed flight and a delayed flight. And what should have been a 3-hour flight took him 12 or so hours. So just know that this interview came at an immense cost and sacrifice from Robert Greene. And I hope you appreciate it accordingly. If you don't know who Robert is, I don't know what to tell you. He is, I think, one of the greatest living nonfiction writers, not just of our time, but of all time. His books on power, strategy, and seduction and war have sold millions upon millions of copies all over the world. The 48 Laws of Power, The Art of Seduction, The 33 Strategies of War, The 50th Law of Mastery, The Laws of Human Nature, and now The Daily Laws, which I was lucky enough to work on him with, all of which we have signed at thepaintedporch.com. You can follow Robert Greene on Instagram, Robert Greene, at Robert Greene Official. You can follow him on Twitter, at Robert Greene. You can follow him on TikTok. He's been doing awesome TikTok stuff, and we filmed a bunch of that while he was here, at Robert Greene. And of course, robertgreene.co. Here's my interview with Robert Greene. I don't need to tell you what it's about, because you should just listen to it, because anytime you get an hour to listen to Robert Greene, you should take that chance, which is what I did. Thanks to Robert for visiting. Check out his many, many books. And check out my past interviews with him as well, and enjoy this one. Talk to you soon. So I thought we'd start with your, I think it's your favorite quote from the Stoics. It's the one you've said to me the most. Maybe you can.
There's two, but I think you know.
This is the boxing one.
Yeah.
Well, what is that quote and what does it mean to you?
Well, I'm going to butcher it to hell. It's, you know, it's better if you tell it to me. I know.
This is the one about the boxers in the ring, right?
Yeah.
So I think Marcus is saying you're like a boxer in the ring. And when someone, he says, when someone gouges you with their nails or butts you with their head, you can't just run away crying or even accuse them of being a cheater. You have to adjust your fighting style accordingly. And he says, you can be wary of them, but like you can't get out of the ring.
Right. Yeah. So it's kind of a metaphor for life. And so the idea is that when you enter the world as an adult, the work world, it is like an arena. It is like a boxing match. Some people play by different set of rules. I forget what the normal boxing rules are called. The name?
No.
It doesn't matter. It's sort of a standard for behavior in a boxing ring. Some people abide by it. Some people don't. They hit below the belt. They hug you. They do all kinds of things that are you're not supposed to do. And, you know, this is like human nature. So Schopenhauer has this quote that if you're walking down the street and you hit your foot against a rock, you don't go get angry at the rock, right? Well, people are rocks in your way sometimes.
Right.
They're just... I don't mean that to depersonalize them. I mean in the sense that they are who they are. They have their own nature, and that nature isn't yours, and it's going to clash with you sometimes. And that is just what it means to be a human being, an adult in the world today, in any world. So are you going to be like complaining and blaming the fact that it is a boxing ring? Are you going to complain that people have a nature where they have an ego, where they're full of envy, where they're passive aggressive, and then in the process of complaining, you're putting yourself at a continual disadvantage because you're draining yourself with all these useless emotions, and you're not playing proper defense against them because you're all consumed with kind of personalizing the situation. Or are you going to have some distance and be like a boxer in a ring and be smart and intelligent about it, you know? And I just think it's a brilliant metaphor for life. It's a brilliant metaphor for being in control and for accepting the fact that some people play a little bit dirty. Some people are going to hit you. It's going to hurt. But you don't whine and complain. You just figure out how are you going to defend yourself better. I thought it was like a perfect metaphor for the 48 laws.
He does seem to really like boxing metaphors. In one passage, he says, like, some people say life is a dance. Mm-hmm. And he says, actually, it's more like wrestling because you have to be dug in and ready for sudden attacks.
Right.
Do you agree? Is life a boxing match or a wrestling match? Like, because you say this in your books all the time. You go, as in war, so in life.
Right.
Is that the lens that you look at the world through?
Well, to some degree, I mean, conflict is kind of inherent in the human condition. So your path through life is never going to be easy. There's always going to be resistance. There's always going to be people who oppose you. When I wrote the war book, the other metaphor was the samurai warrior. That was a major theme in it. And Musashi talks about the stance of the warrior.
Yeah.
And it's the stance that matters. It's how you meet the adversary, how you position yourself, how you're calm, how you position the sword, and how you're ready for the attack. The attack might not come, or the opponent might just give up and walk away, or there may be somebody who come from behind, but you're ready, you're prepared, you're in the proper stance. So I always think of it kind of in those terms. Are you prepared? So I don't want people to be paranoid. I don't want them to go around thinking everybody's evil and they're about to attack me. I want you to be in life, to have this kind of composure, this stance like a warrior. You're prepared for the worst. You're not expecting the worst, but you're prepared for it if it happens. And if some kind of crap comes your way, you know how to fight, and you know how to defend yourself, and you know how to get out of bad situations. And I say that because I myself, before I wrote the book, I violated a lot of times. The stance that I was in was all wobbly. I was too emotional. I wasn't strong. I wasn't like in a firm position, etc. So
I was thinking, my other favorite Marcus sort of wrestling boxing one is he says, it's, and maybe Musashi would get mad at this, but he says it's better to be a boxer than a fencer or a swordsman, because the boxer's weapon is a part of them and the swordsman has to pick up their weapon. And I always took that, when I read that passage the first time, I thought of the final law of the law of power about formlessness, uh-huh, becoming one with whatever it is that you do and not, yeah, needing any external things. You are fused with the defenses or the tools that is a part of what you do.
Well, you know, Musashi would counter Marcus Aurelius. It would be a great discussion. I wish we could bring them back together.
I know, it'd be incredible.
But Musashi would counter it in that the great samurai warrior becomes one with his weapon.
Yeah.
It is simply an extension of his arm. And he had a famous sword fight. He had many very classic famous sword fights where he didn't have a sword. And he
used like a stick. Or
he used like an oar.
Yeah.
Right? And he defeated his opponent. So it didn't matter that it was necessarily this hard piece of steel. It was how he used it. And he thought of it as an extension of his arm. So, you know, it was literally not like a prosthesis. It was literally a part of him.
I'm writing about Musashi a little bit in the Temperance book.
Oh, good. He's amazing.
And there's a story that I didn't get to use, but I loved it so much. He was in this fight and he would always do these sort of destabilizing, like, yeah, he would always win the fight before he got there.
Yeah.
He'd be late or, he'd be weird or, he'd dress strangely.
Yeah.
But in this one, he shows up and he's late or something. The guy's really angry. And the guy takes out his sword and he throws his scabbard into the ocean. And Musashi says, "Ah, so you know you're going to lose." Uh-huh. Because a winner would not have thrown their scabbard away.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I just, and you could tell, like, that would have just confused and broken the spirit of the person. I love, like, his sort of quips and his ability to sort of think through what the other person is expecting, what they want. And he'll do anything, even potentially a dishonorable thing or thing that would be viewed as dishonorable, yeah, to destabilize that person. Mm-hmm. So even though they might have been equally matched or he might have been outmatched, Musashi would win.
He was the Bill Belichick of samurai warrior fighting.
Whatever your strength is, I'm gonna undermine it.
Yeah. So the other thing about Musashi that's brilliant, that's very applicable to life, was he treated each opponent as different. He never repeated the same strategy twice. He surmised the opponent either before the fight or during the fight, to see what their psychology was, see what their weaknesses were, what their strengths were, so he could neutralize their strength. And he never repeated the same strategy twice. He always looked at his opponent as an individual. I have to adapt to their style. I have to mirror them sometimes. So he had this one quote about, "If I yawn and I feel tired, I will induce that in my opponent because emotions are contagious."
Sure.
Although I'm not really yawning and feeling it, I'm going to make this person tired by my apparent lackadaisical attitude. So I found that brilliant, you know, because so many people in life, they're bad strategists. Most people are awful strategists because they're locked in the past And they're constantly repeating what worked a week ago, a month ago, a year ago. They don't look at the individuals they're dealing with, their employees, and say, this person has a particular psychology, this one's very different, I have to approach each person differently. They take the path of least resistance, and they do this kind of cookie cutter approach where I'm just going to apply the same strategies to each person. And Musashi was the complete opposite of that.
I was thinking about doing a chapter about that towards the end of the temperance book, because people tend to think stoicism is having no emotions. But what I thought was so genius about Musashi, and I'll give you another example of this, but like, he's not only not emotional, or he's so transcended his emotions that he's able to use emotion effectively, right? And like, I think about this, like when a basketball coach will get a technical on purpose, or like, how does one, if you think it's about stripping emotion out of things, maybe that is part of it, but that's like beginner level. That's like basic. But the real thing is to be able to understand emotions, process them, and then use them, or at the very least, understand other people's emotions and be able to manipulate's the wrong word, but use those emotions to help them or you accomplish what is supposed to be accomplished.
Yeah, I mean, the proper idea to me is sort of a lot of what I meditate about and is in Buddhism, where you don't try to repress your emotions, because first of all, you can't. We are emotional animals. And if ever you have tried to repress your emotions, particularly in a state of meditation, you see you have zero control over them, right? They're popping up. You know, it's the way we're wired. So the proper stance is, I'm not going to repress emotions, but I'm going to understand them. I'm going to see them as they occur with a degree of distance. I'm going to see that I'm angry in this moment. I'm going to almost like have a, I like to imagine it as if I'm like six inches away from myself. I don't know why that metaphor come up.
But I'm only looking, 6 inches? That doesn't seem that far.
Well, it's out this side. It's like here. However, okay. That's like more like a foot, I guess. Right? And I'm looking at what I'm thinking or feeling from that distance, almost from the outside. And I'm still feeling it, but I'm seeing it as if it's from, as if I'm another person. I know this is a strange concept.
Yeah.
But you can observe your own emotions while you're feeling them. And then they don't have power over you. Then you can say, okay, I'm angry. Why am I angry? So number one, I recognize the emotion. Number two, why am I angry? Is it stemmed from something weeks ago, months ago, or earlier today? And then what do I do with my anger? Sometimes you want to use your anger. You want to channel your anger. So when you're in sports, if you don't have that kind of drive and that anger, when you're in a bet, you know, when you're down by 12 points.
It's like an extra gear.
Yeah.
You can pull. Yeah.
There's a little bit of anger and even, I don't know, hatred or something. You just despise the enemy. You're going to crush them, right? You use that emotion. But as Phil Jackson said, if that emotion controls you throughout 48 minutes of a game, you're useless. You drain yourself. Right. You can't control it.
You also make mistakes.
You make mistakes. So you need to be focused, but you also need to be able to use those emotions. That's where I use that metaphor of the rider and the horse, which I've repeated many, many times. Maybe that's another medallion that we could.
Yeah.
Can manufacture.
No, that's a great idea. The other Belichick thing I was thinking is, you know, that's what everyone goes, Bill Belichick takes your best asset and he brings it to zero. He basically, if you're throwing team, he figures out how to stop the throw. If you're running team, he stops the run. But I think he also doesn't get enough credit. Like, did you watch the Patriots Buffalo game? I think it was last week.
Painful, but I did.
He also is aware of whatever his weakest thing is, and he makes that a non-entity in the game.
What was that in this case?
Well, so they were playing in Buffalo in like the strongest wind.
Yes, snowing.
And they threw the ball three times.
That's right.
And it was the most boring,
unsexy
game, but they gutted it out. But like, I was amazed at this, both the self-control, but then you also have to have a certain amount of confidence and not giving a shit what other people think, because like, think about how many people he made unhappy by only throwing the ball three times. Quarterback's mad. The offensive coordinator's mad. The quarterback's coach is mad. Yeah. The announcer is mad. The fans are mad.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, I don't care. Like he will win in the ugliest possible way.
Yeah, yeah.
And he almost likes winning that way more, I think.
Yeah. And he also adapts, as we were talking about, adapts the strategy. So
right.
he's very good at like figuring out the opposing quarterback and what their weaknesses are, the weather conditions, the conditions of the field, the psychology of the moment. He's very aware of all of the details, which is what made Napoleon such a great field general. Because Napoleon, people don't understand, he was not only brilliant at coming up with a plan, but he was brilliant in the moment, adapting his strategies to what the opponent showed him, because he created what's called maneuver warfare, which is probably similar to what a Belichick does. And maneuver warfare isn't about the position you occupy. It's about the options that you have.
Right.
So you put yourself in a position where you can go in five different directions, five different arrows. And if the moment comes, you can go here, 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 depending on what shows up, right? As opposed to the typical Prussian general who, I'm going to go this way and attack, you know.
Sheer force and strength.
Or even I'm going to make a flanking attack this way, and they only have one gear and they only go one way. So, and Belichick, he's always kind of adapting his strategy to each game instead of like running the ball completely. Sometimes when Brady was the quarterback, he would throw 54 times, et cetera. Yeah. Yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah, and they were so he the way he chose to like after they won the coin toss or whatever, he chose it so they would
they'd be playing
with the wind at the he's like, I don't care how bad we are for the first three quarters. What matters is the wind at our backs
right.
when we need to make the final play.
Right,
to win
exactly.
The game.
Exactly.
That's like one of my second I think. Obviously, the Rams Super Bowl is another great example.
That was so painful, but that was.
But imagine how hard it would be to play a painful game in front of literally the entire world. Like, you know, everyone's watching, everyone's mad at you, and you just don't care.
Well, he's also a bit like the character I wrote about in the 48 Laws of Power, Chuko Liang. And Chuko Liang was in the Chinese I forget what the War of Three Romances, whatever it's called, was such a brilliant general. He was the one who sat on top of the gates playing a guitar and humming, and he had no army.
Yeah.
And the opponent comes up with like, you know, 20,000 men, and they see him on the gates all tranquil in monk's robes. He's like singing. This guy's up to some trick because he's always has tricks up his bag.
Right.
We're going to turn around and leave. And he only had like 40 people defending this castle.
Yeah.
It was his reputation. And it's almost like people are defeated by Bill Belichick before they get in the stadium because they're anticipating.
Because he's Darth Vader.
He's playing with your mind before you even get there. And I know that's what happened to Jared Goff when he was the quarterback of the Rams.
We chose to do something that we've never done here before at Daily Stoic. For 1 week only, you can sign up and immediately begin the 2022 New Year, New You Challenge at your own pace. We recorded, edited, timestamped my live Q&As. That's 3 hours of me answering questions on a wide variety of topics, including how I applied Stoicism to my own life, my goals, my practices. We talk about what to do when you're overwhelmed, when you've taken on too much, ways to rethink your habits, routines when life gets too chaotic, and so much more. You get the benefit of all the other people who've been through the challenge and what they've learned and shared as well. And additionally, the New Year, New You Challenge participants get 21 custom challenges delivered daily that will help you stop procrastinating, gain clarity on the life you want to live, learn new skills. Again, this is just for a week. If you procrastinated earlier in the year, if you told yourself you were going to get around to it, you missed it, well, you got a second chance. You've been given a do-over, a reprieve. You can sign up at dailystoic.com/challenge. And as always, if you're a Daily Stoic Life member, that's dailystoiclife.com, you get this challenge and all the challenges that we have planned for the year for free. So check that out, dailystoiclife.com, and of course, dailystoic.com/challenge. Another Marcus quote that I think ties in really well with your books. He says, you can't go around expecting Plato's Republic. And what I love about the Stoics, although Seneca is sort of an edge case in that, you know, he's not totally admirable, but like the Stoics weren't these sort of theoretical philosophers, but they had to be philosophers in the emperor's court or in the real world, in the army, in business in the Roman Empire. Just what does it mean to you when you hear, like, you can't go around expecting Plato's Republic?
You know, Seneca, first of all, you know, they're trying to, like, that maybe Nero wasn't so bad.
He did kill his mom.
Okay, but for the time, that was pretty normal.
He only tried to murder his mom several times and was successful. All right,
was pretty evil, too.
No, I know what you mean. Yeah, some people are arguing that maybe Nero wasn't as bad as they thought. Okay,
but, you know, rehabilitate Seneca's reputation here a little bit, because I feel bad for him. But, I mean, Machiavelli has that quote, so that if you expect everybody to be good in this world, you're in a lot of trouble. You know, what are you going to do when you deal with people who aren't good? But, yeah, you have to be willing to get your hands dirty. So let's say a classic example, like there's a cause that's very important to you, like the climate or, you know, justice in America, you know, racial justice in America, all very important issues that most of us believe in. You know, if you have to be willing to get down and dirty here, because you're playing with politics, you're playing with people who are going to resist, you're playing with major corporations who are going to bust your balls, who are going to be incredibly manipulative and downright evil in co-opting your good idea and kind of, you know, neutralizing it. So if you're going to be, if you want to create something, if you want to actually have results, you have to be willing to get a little dirty, and you have to be willing to be strategic. You have to understand that the other side might not be playing by the same rules that you're playing with. You know, a lot of warfare is with asymmetry, not just of weapons, but of also of ethics. You know, like the Democrats and the Republicans, I know those people are going to rant about that. Or when we're going against Vladimir Putin, these are people who have more options than we do because they're ethically not bound by the same norms that we have.
There's self-imposed limitation. The self-imposed limitations are a one-way street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I talk in my books about two people, Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King, and how at certain moments where they were so invested in the results of getting the English out of India, of bringing racial justice to America, that they were willing to do things that were actually a bit kind of manipulative, downright manipulative. So that's where it's, you know.
But that's another point, too. It's not just that it was manipulative, like, in that they, you know, Martin Luther King deciding, like, hey, we're going to use children in some of these marches, because even though we know they're likely going to be in danger, because it will help. But I think it's also the key there, to me, is going, just because your cause is right, and this ties in directly to the laws of power about never appeal to mercy, always appeal to self-interest. Like, just because your cause is correct or right or just, you can't just expect everyone else to be on board with that. So it's not, they also understood they had to convince people, they had to get them to see something.
Yeah.
So they understood that it just wasn't theirs, because they were on the right side of history.
Right. And so he made an exchange where he was putting these children in danger because it was Bull Connor, whoever was the sheriff at the time. You had the whips out and everything. But he knew that it was going to play on television in white people's homes in Chicago, who had kind of, they didn't have an image of America being like this. They never saw the dogs being taken out and the whips and the water cannons. And he was going to put it on your television set, right?
Yeah. He was going to make them understand the lies they were telling themselves about segregation.
Yeah. And Gandhi's strategy was exactly the same. They didn't have television back then, but in his salt march, he literally was inviting his followers to be beaten up, clubbed by the English police or whoever it was. And that would be in the newspapers. And English people who were very liberal and thought their country was, you know, the great hope of the world, be reading in this paper about defenseless people being clubbed, and it would turn them against the empire, right?
Right.
So, yeah, that's exactly what your point is.
Yeah, it's like might doesn't make right, and right doesn't make might. You have to figure out how to sell whatever it is that you're selling, and understanding that, yeah, most people are indifferent as best, or they have some vested interest in not caring about what you're talking about. I think about that even as like a writer. It's like, no, not that many people like books. You know, like you're it's an uphill battle to get people to read a book. And so you can't just expect that because you care a lot about it, everyone else will care.
Right. Well, it's hard. It's not natural for us to get outside of ourselves. Our natural position, which is sort of what I talked about in human nature about our narcissism that we all have, is I have a great idea. Everybody must think it's a great idea.
Right.
I think the world is this way and should be this way. Everybody should be feeling that way, you know? It's just natural.
Sure.
But it takes effort to get outside of yourself and to imagine that people come from different cultural backgrounds. They weren't raised like you. They're a different gender. They're a different race. They have different backgrounds and different belief systems. To try to think about that and to also think about the universal qualities that all people share, you know? And so the problem, if you could boil down the problem with humans into one line, it's the fact that they're always taking the path of least resistance. They don't want to put effort. And it requires effort to strategize, to think of your opponent, to think of what makes them different. It takes strategy to think of what will persuade them, what will get people to join your cause. You know, it takes effort to get outside of yourself to see how other people might view it. But we don't want to do that. We want to just be lazy and just assume that everyone's on our side.
Yeah, or we just want it because it is better for the world. Of course, the world should do it.
Yeah.
And that's, people do the wrong thing or act in not their self-interest all the time.
Yeah.
I love this quote, and I read it at the beginning of the pandemic, and it's been helpful to me. I think it kind of connects to what you're talking about in the Sublime book. Marx Aurelius in Meditations, he says he learns from one of his mentors that the key to happiness is to be free of passion, but full of love. What does that mean to you?
I'm not quite sure. I don't know if I, can you help me a little bit and then I'll riff?
I was taking it as meaning like, you're not angry, you're not jealous, you're not frustrated. Like the passions, the sort of negative emotions as the Stoics
talk about. So love isn't a passion?
But that love is some sort of deeper emotion, some better way to go through the world. That of all the passions, that was the one that was okay. Love.
Okay, so love is a passion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's something that, you know, I believe very much so. And it is kind of touching upon the sublime. But all the other passions are very inward moving, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're about you.
Yeah.
They're about your anger. They're about your frustration. Yes, you could be angry because some people are doing some really fucked up things to you at some point, right? So it's not completely you, but the emotion is geared towards how you feel, and you want to get retribution if someone's hurt you. You want revenge, you know? So it's all very kind of self-centered. But love is the one emotion that forces you outside of yourself. True love, because there can be fake love where you're really, it's just a form of narcissism where you want people to give you the attention,
right,
and feed the image you have of yourself. But true love, the ability to get outside of yourself and to feel what other people are feeling, which is empathy. And empathy, which is a word I'm afraid that's overused, and I'm getting a little tired of it. I wish we could find a better word. But it's a major theme in the sublime, because the idea is the highest mental power that we humans have, the source really of our intelligence, is what they call theory of mind, that we are able to place ourselves in the bodies and the minds of other people. It's what's made us the supreme social animal, right?
To be able to think about what someone else is thinking.
Yeah. And it's not only just for love, it's also for fighting your opponent, et cetera, and for dealing any kind of social situation. But it's the source of all of our intelligence, right? It's the source of our science. A great scientist like an Einstein is thinking inside the very subjects he's trying to get into, right?
And that's where his metaphors and analogies often come from, because he's able to think about it. Oh, this is like this.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's the source of our power. And so high-level empathy, where you're able to think inside of other people to kind of imagine what they are going through, what their feelings are, is to me the highest passion of all, which is a form of love, and it is extremely sublime.
Yeah, no, I think it's like, so instead of being like, you look at what's happening in the world, you could be angry someone's behaving this way or doing this selfish thing. And then it's like, to me, the Stoic exercise is like, well, why are they this way? Well, it's because someone misled them. They're actually a victim of the, although they're perpetrating a, you know, something unethical or unfair or unjust, they're a victim because someone, they're a victim of a scam or a scheme or a bad actor. And then also they are suffering for that. It's not fun to be them.
Right.
And that I'm lucky not to have experienced that. And that so if you can experience this sort of compassion, it's almost more than empathy. It's like a compassion or understanding for that person. Then you can feel love towards them instead of anger or rage or despair about like, why are people that way?
But can you do that with the anti-vaxxers?
It's hard. on a good day, I can.
I was wondering if you're maybe reaching your limits of that there.
Well, I mean, it's a tricky thing, right? Because it is, you can understand where they're coming from just in the same way that you could understand, you know, let's say addiction is a disease and that this being addicted to this or that has caused so much pain and suffering for that person. And it's part of some wound that they had as a child and it's not fun to be them and that life would be better for them if they were clean, but you know, they still broke into your house and stole a family heirloom to sell, to buy drugs, or they still got high and crashed their car and they killed someone. So I think we're really struggling with that particularly is you can have empathy and understanding for the person, but that doesn't negate the fact that the thing they're doing has real consequences for other people.
Definitely. But if you want to, if you want to win this war, let's call it a war against this type of thinking, you can't just like get angry and close the door on them and just say, go away. You know, you're evil. You're bad. We have to live with them, right? They're in our midst every day. And so if our politicians and people in charge were smart, which they're not, they would have that mentality. They would have the idea that you can't just alienate people and antagonize them and push them further into their corner.
But to go to say like the civil rights movement, obviously Martin Luther King talks a lot about justice and loving the enemy. And even though they hurt him, and you know, there's a famous moment where Martin Luther King's on stage and a man just comes in, a Nazi, just starts punching him in the face.
Right, right.
And Martin Luther King has this almost superhuman discipline.
Right.
People said he dropped his hands. Like he didn't even go like this.
Are you using this in temperance?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like to me, that's the heroic level of temperance.
Yeah,
it's not just, oh, someone called you a bad name and you didn't react. Like he conquered it to the level where he didn't go like this.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. It's amazing.
He talked about all that. And yet he also understood that segregation could only be destroyed through the force of law.
But how do you get the force of law?
I mean,
you can't force the force of law.
I mean, those little girls and boys didn't go to school at Little Rock High School without the 101st Airborne.
Yeah, but how did you get the 101st Airborne? How did you get Kennedy or Johnson to do that? How did you move public opinion to get to that point?
No, I'm just saying it's both.
You can't compel people in any way. So even to get Congress or the president to mandate vaccinations like they've done in other countries, you're going to get immense pushback, right?
Right.
So how are you going to deal with that?
Well, I think Martin Luther King said somewhere, I'm paraphrasing, it was like, you know, you can't make my neighbor like me, but you can prevent him from killing me. Yeah. Like, so it's both. It needed sort of the force of law as well as a sort of a public opinion campaign. We need both, and we kind of have neither.
Yeah, yeah.
Seneca has this thing that it's really popular when we post it on Daily Stoic, but I still struggle with what it means. He says, we suffer more in imagination than reality. Mm-hmm. Now, I think he's saying, and I was talking to a friend who's sort of dreading this thing that's going to happen. He's worried about this negative news article that's going to come out. And I was talking to him about it, and I was saying, look, like, it's going to happen, and it's going to either be really negative or not that negative. But you're borrowing the suffering in advance. You're you're feeling crappy about it before it's happened. It's like if they told you, Robert, you're going to have to spend 10 years in prison, but you have 6 months to get your affairs in order. Those 6 months of your life should not be miserable, even though the 10 years probably aren't going to be fun, because then you're actually serving a 10 and a half year sentence. Mm-hmm. But I think Seneca's point is even a lot of the things we dread don't even happen. So it's even worse. We dread it in advance and then it doesn't happen.
Yeah. So what don't you understand?
I'm just curious, what does that quote mean to you?
Well, it makes me think of my meditation again. I hope I'm not sounding like a one-trick pony here. But so when I'm meditating, I become extremely aware that thinking is almost a form of a disease. I get that idea constantly as I'm meditating. Like thoughts are coming up, and they're negative thoughts. 90% of the thoughts that come up uncontrollably are about anxiety. They're about people who've done things to you that you don't like. It's about problems with people, etc. So many of the thoughts are negative, and you're anticipating, as you say, negative things happening to you. And it's almost like thinking is the problem itself because it divorces you from the moment.
Right.
So I often have the idea as I'm meditating, there's a world out there that has nothing to do with me. That's completely indifferent to Robert Greene. The birds could care less about my fate. The trees don't know anything about my existence. The sky doesn't care at all about me, right? Okay, that's the reality. That's the world. But my thinking creates this thing as if I'm the most important thing in the universe, that everything that happens is going to happen to me and is going to be bad, etc. So to be able to see that thinking traps you so many times into patterns that you've been programmed to respond to situations, a lot of times by anxiety, you know, like thoughts pop up about, oh, I've got to do this phone call, or, oh, I forgot to email that person, or damn it, that this interview is coming up and I don't want to do it, or blah, 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 blah. So much of the thoughts are anxieties that you're anticipating
right.
What's going to happen, right? If you can just control that, if you could just see that is the source of your problem and that the world is indifferent to you and that the circumstances are totally neutral and that newspaper article that comes out, you can't control it. And maybe the bad stuff will actually in the end rebound to your favor, or it'll make you tougher. It'll make you realize certain things. If you can just see them as facts, as opposed to like these horrible things inside your head, these phantasmos, whatever the Latin word is, you know, then you've got the power.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. Well, and the irony, and I think this is very common, so I'm not singling this person out, but like, so he's dreading the thing, he's worried about it, what's going to mean, what's going to happen, blah, blah, blah. And then I was like, so have you written your response? You know, we've talked about it like a dozen times. But the one thing he controls would be like, what's he going? I was like, you should have written, this is your response if they say this. This is your response if they say this. This is your response if you say this. This is how you've already prepared all the people in your life that this thing might be happening. But of course, none of that was done because it was almost, even though it was, he's making himself miserable, it was more pleasure. It was more rewarding to just sit and stew and worry than to, like the Stoics say, look, you don't control what's in the, what's going to happen, but you control how you respond to what happens. Mm. And you also can control how you prepare for what happens. But we don't do that.
Well, you know who one of the great Stoics of the 20th century was?
No.
Alfred Hitchcock.
He had a plan for everything.
So directing a film, if you've known other people who've done it, is an extremely stressful job. It's like directing an army into a campaign because problems are arising that you cannot anticipate. There's all this pressure. There's all this money. You've got insane egos of actors, producers, etc. And so it's like, it's a constant adrenaline rush going through. You can't control your emotions. So Hitchcock, people would look at him on the set and he'd be falling asleep in the director's chair. He'd look like Buddha. His eyes were closed. Why? Because he prepared for everything. He anticipated everything that was going to happen, right? And so by the time the film came, he was completely bored because he knew he was able to control every aspect of the production. So I know, for instance, if I have to go on live television, which is almost like having a sword fight with Musashi, right? Mm-hmm. For 10 minutes, everyone around the world is seeing you live. If you say something stupid or you blank out, you're humiliated.
Or if you're boring, they'll cut the interview short.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. It's the worst thing. It's the worst. I don't know if you can agree with me, but it's one of the worst things ever. So what I've learned is I'm going to prepare the hell out of it. I'm going to have everything nailed down, right? And then sometimes they don't ask you the questions you anticipated. Goes off in other directions. But when you enter that green room or where you're ready to be interviewed, you have a calmness because you prepared, you know what your answers are going to be. You're able to, you're not sitting there in the moment trying to figure things out. So I think that's kind of similar to what you're saying there.
I heard a thing about Bill Walsh, the football coach. He would script his first 15 plays of the game.
For that.
So it was irrelevant what was happening in the world because he had his plan. Now that might have made him a little unflexible in some ways, but it also meant that if something went wrong, he wasn't scrambling, running around he wasn't looking for order and direction because like there was a plan and all he had to do was stick to the plan.
Right. And those 15 plays were also geared towards the opponent. They weren't just random plays that he devised, you know.
Right. No, and it's about so much of life, I think, even like the interview you're talking about, it's about settling into a rhythm. It's about you go into it with nerves that are not beneficial. So it's really about just you have the initial rush. How do you prevent the crash after the rush? How do you just get into the groove that you need to do your thing?
The other thing I advise people, a lot of it, stressful situation or job interviews. And the best defense is to be so thoroughly prepared. You've studied that company like it's the back of your hand. You know the person who's interviewing. You've done massive amounts of research. You've just done all the detail work. And you've prepared what more or less you're going to say. Then you go in, it's a completely different mindset than if you're just going to like wing it.
But I think some people think the anticipation thing can lead to anxiety or worry. But there's a Napoleon quote I like where he says, the general should ask themselves 3 times a day, what would I do if the enemy appears here, here, here?
Yeah.
I don't think he wanted the generals to be anxious. He just wanted them to be aware, like to have a plan.
Well, preparation, that's why Hitchcock could fall asleep. When you're prepared, you're calm, right?
Yeah.
So when you've done your work, you know, and you get on the golf course or you get in the boxing ring or you get on the interview stage, yeah, you're going to be nervous. And yeah, you're going to have adrenaline, because I've found if you don't have adrenaline, you're not focused enough. You need a little bit of nervous energy.
Sure.
But there's a difference between being nervous energy and it forecloses your ability to think in the moment. But when you're prepared, you're able to be calmer. And then if people surprise you with a question, you're not suddenly flustered, because you entered with it with a much higher degree of calmness than when if you try to just completely fling it. I don't know if you've had that experience.
No, I think you need a little bit of that energy. It's like, it's just a heightened state of awareness. It's not sustainable. Like, you can't do it every day of your life, but you need to go into an extra, enter an extra sphere or plane to do your best work, I feel like. Seneca talks about, he has this Latin expression, which I won't say because I'll probably butcher it, but he says, like, the whole world is a temple of the gods. And I think one of the most, you know, people think of Marcus Aurelius as this sort of dour, depressive, like, guy. But, like, my favorite parts of meditations are his, like, observations about nature.
Yeah.
He talks about, like, wheat bending low under its own weight. Yeah. He talks about the flecks of foam on a boar's mouth. He talks about olives falling from the tree.
Yeah.
It's clear that he would walk, he would go outside, yes, but he was also aware of what's happening outside. He was connected and present, like Da Vinci, the way he would fall in love with the way a bird flew, or even like what a body looked like when you cut it open. To me, that's part of the sublime stuff too, an actual understanding and awe. Like, we use that word awesome, but we don't really think about what it means, but just awe seems so important.
I wonder what the etymology of awe is. I should look that up.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing that's similar to, and it's from Marcus Aurelius that's related, is look at things as they are. So you're drinking wine, think of the grapes being crushed. You're having olive oil, think of the olives being crushed. I don't remember what the other examples were.
It's a little, this is, I think, one of the reasons people think he's kind of depressing. He's like, this is a dead pig. This is a dead bird.
Well, yeah, but that's what the food that you're eating, you know?
Sure.
Yeah, and so, you know, that's a lot of the sublime, because you're walking around in your world and you're kind of sleepwalking.
Yeah.
You're not paying attention to things and you're not really seeing things as they are. So you're drinking your orange juice from some plastic bottle. You're not aware of the oranges or the process or what people went through. I mean, I know that if you were, that might not be that exciting. So that's maybe not the best example. But being aware of where things come from, of what they are, of what their true nature is, you know, that's sort of what children, how the children think, because they're constantly curious. They just don't assume that something just came into the world the way it is. They want to know how and they want to know why. So you live in a world where you're surrounded by things that exist that kind of, you don't really know where they come from or what makes them so interesting, and you're not paying attention to it. So some people have this idea of the sublime, like you have to do these incredible things. It has to be some amazing experience. You have to climb Mount Everest to have that rush and just look down on the world. Or you have to be in a space, you know, you have to be with Jeff Bezos on Blue Origin. Sure. You know, it's pathetic. It's stupid. It's silly. The sublime is like around you. It's around just looking at your skin, realizing your own body, your own physiology. It's in everything around you is weird and sublime if you look at it a certain way.
Well, I think about that with, so it's like, it's easy to look at the Grand Canyon and be awestruck.
Yeah.
It's easy to, look at something amazing and be awestruck. But the point is, can you find that in the ordinary or even in the ugly, right? Can you see the steam coming out of a sewer in New York City or like cat footprints on a car?
I just wrote about that in the pagan chapter, because in the Aztec cosmology, they have a word that I'm going to butcher, but it was called Tlazocayotl, and it meant, literally means sacred excrement. And it means that there was a god of excrement and filth, and even the filth is beautiful and sacred. And so I write about how you can look at things that are kind of decaying or that smell kind of funky, and you can find that kind of exciting and interesting in its own way. The decay has a certain kind of poignancy. to it, right?
Some decaying things almost have a sweet smell to them.
Yeah, yeah. I forget what we were talking about.
I relate that to gratitude, right? So people go, it's important to be grateful. So then like on Thanksgiving, they're like, I'm grateful for my family. I'm grateful for my health.
I remember.
Right? And that is important. But I also think gratitude as a practice should be like, how do you find a way to be grateful for the shit that you don't like, that you didn't want to happen, right? Again, it's easy to be grateful that you're rich or that you're like free or that you're this or that, but can you be grateful for like your broken leg? Or can you be grateful for that terrible relationship that you are in? Can you be grateful that all this, I was trying to think about this the other day, how can I be grateful for all the frustrating state of the world? Well, what's to be grateful there? Well, it's an opportunity, right? To be not those things, right?
Right.
If I was thinking about the town that I live in, if it was perfect and the things that I didn't like about it were not there, almost certainly I would not be able to afford to live here.
Well, this town's pretty perfect.
No, but you get what I mean. Yeah. Like even writing a book, if writing the book was easy, mm-hmm. either everyone would do it or you wouldn't be paid what you're paid to do it, right? You realize that the whole fact that it's hard or difficult or not perfect is what made it possible, accessible, or potentially rewarding.
Yeah, it makes me think of two things. So I was reading recently a biography of William James, the great American philosopher, psychologist, and he has this great essay, I forget which one it's called, where he went to this like perfect utopia colony in New York called Chautauqua, where everything was easy and wonderful and everybody was so polite and they were all playing games outside and it was nature, there was no conflict, and it was like this paradise. And he felt after he was there for 2 days, he wanted to throw up. He thought it the most repulsive thing he'd ever been to. He says, when you take conflict away from a human being, it's like castrating them. You remove something essential from our nature. And he found it horrifying and nightmarish, which is kind of like what a utopia could be like. The other thing is, well, you know, what about like, I'm not trying to be so self-centered here, but I guess I am, having a stroke. You know, it's not fun. You know, you can't
wish it on someone.
I wouldn't wish it on anyone, not even a certain someone whose name I won't mention. So, you know, your active life is taken away from you and you have to learn a patience that does never existed. It takes you 5 minutes to tie your shoelaces, et cetera. What could you be grateful for that? Well, it's true. You can. It's taught me a lot of things. It's made me very kind of humble and appreciate what I had and also understand what it feels like for other people to be helpless physically, to have greater degrees of empathy. It has taught me to appreciate the smaller things in life. It's, for example, I could have had a stroke that damaged the left side of my brain, in which case I wouldn't be able to write a book. So which would be worse, having the right side of my brain damaged so I can't walk, or the left side of my brain where I can't write another book? I would take what happened to me over the other one. So even this kind of worst thing, it's the worst thing that's ever happened to me, but of course getting COVID could be theoretically a lot worse. And I have a friend who got COVID and then had a stroke. So there's always worse in this world, but you know, there's even good to be extracted from the worst thing that happened in your life without getting Pollyannish about it, because a lot of it's painful and frustrating, but you do have to look at it that way because you can't control it. You know, there's nothing you can do.
That's one of my favorite Marcus quotes. I think it ties to what you're saying. He says, in Meditations, Marcus says, a strong stomach digests what it eats. A fire turns everything you throw on top of it into flame and brightness.
It's a great quote. I love that quote.
What does it mean to you?
It just means that everything that happens, you consume it in a particular way and you turn it into, you know, that fire inside of you just consumes all circumstances into something positive. You just burn them up and you evaporate them and you make them part of your life and you incorporate them. And I don't know. I might be butchering it, but or I might be getting the context wrong.
No, I think you're totally right. The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. I talk about that in Growth Hacker Marketing. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stoic. That's netsuite.com/stoic.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
As I've thought about that quote more, the one thing that I've came to understand is, like, if you've ever started like a campfire or something, and then you're like, it starts to get going, and then you get excited and you throw too much on it, it puts the fire out.
Right.
Right. So what I think he's really commenting on is like, how strong, how robust is that fire inside of you?
Yeah.
If it's just a puny little spark or you know, it's that one of those fires that's more smoke than heat, you can also, putting stuff on top of it can also dampen it out or block it out. So it's really about how much you have going on in here. That's the that's how you hear about somebody who goes through an incredible amount of adversity. Marcus Aurelius lost, I think, 7 children. Like, you think about what kind, or you think about Admiral Stockdale and the Hanoi Hilton, just what kind of inner fortitude and strength and drive and inner power you would have for one of those things not to break you, not every single one right after another.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so this makes me think of two things. So I'm right now writing a chapter about childhood sublime, and kind of the main story, the icon of it, is the writer Vladimir Nabokov, wrote Lolita, among many other great novels. And he had this kind of idyllic childhood in Russia, a wealthy father and really kind of this doting mother and this country estate. It was kind of like here. He just was paradise. And then it's 1918 or 17, and he's 18 years old, and the Russian Revolution breaks out. And his father's a marked man, and they have to flee. They have to leave behind all of their possessions. They flee to Europe. They end up in Berlin. His father is assassinated by a fascist. His wife is Jewish, and they're there when Hitler comes to power. And they have to flee Germany. He has to leave behind his mother and all his siblings.
So a second time?
Yeah, second time. And his brother dies in a concentration camp. And he flees to New York. And here he is. He's in his 40s. And he had the most happy childhood. And yet he has no photographs, no souvenirs, no family members to share it with. He can never go back to Russia because of Stalin and the circumstances. And yet, what does he do? You know, that's like just horrifying. So his idea was he was going to recreate his childhood in his mind. He was going to make it come to life just by imagining it and feeling those emotions again. So that was kind of his fire. I don't know if that's sort
of... No, like any one of those things could be, if you're like, why is that person a drunk? It'd be like, because one of those things happened to them.
Yeah.
But the people that I think are so amazing, the people who sort of keep going, like, they just published this new edition of some of the writings of Viktor Frankl.
Yeah.
And it's called Yes to Life.
Right.
And the subtitle is In Spite of Everything.
Well, who went through worse than Viktor Frankl?
But I love that phrase, like, in spite of everything.
Right.
It's not, life is not Plato's Republic. It's not your idyllic childhood. It's not how you want it
to be. It's Auschwitz.
Yeah. You have to do these things we're talking about in spite of. So you think about Marcus Aurelius and what he's talking about, like how to be free of passion, full of love. You can't expect Plato's Republic, this or that. He's not having a good time. Like, that, even the ancient historians were like, this was this wonderful man who met with continual bad luck in life, but it never seemed to pierce that inner scent. Like, he never became bitter. He never despaired. He never abandoned. It would have been so easy, as you're burying your second child, to be like, you know what? It's all bullshit. Like, I quit. But he never did that.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. It would have been interesting to be inside of his mind at that time and to see, like, the struggles, because you know there was a struggle.
Of course.
You know it wasn't, like, easy to do that, and that it took a process, and that it would be interesting because we only have his meditations, basically. But what if we had more of that? It would be so exciting to see. You'd have to kind of just completely read between the lines. So little is known of his life.
Well, when I read between the lines, I see him talking about not losing your temper.
Despairing. Yeah, yeah.
He talks about reaching for your child and they're not there.
Yeah.
So clearly he was struggling with all these things.
But he wasn't.
The journal was where he worked it out.
Yeah. But so people have this wrong impression about Stoicism, which came back to sort of something we were talking about yesterday, where they kind of accuse you sometimes of not being Stoic, or it's a struggle.
Yeah, sure.
Even for Marcus Aurelius, it was a continual struggle. Even for Epictetus, or however you pronounce it, it was a continual struggle. It's not like you're suddenly a Stoic, you got a diploma, and now you're continually struggling with your human nature.
And if it wasn't a struggle, would it be that admirable? Like,
yeah.
if you were just born that way, or if it was you read this book and then you magically become this way, how impressive would that be? It's like we love the Tom Brady's of the world or the whatever, because they shouldn't be able to do what they're doing because they were a 6-round draft pick because they're not. Drew Brees isn't tall enough.
Yeah.
You know, Spud Webb isn't tall enough.
Yeah.
Tom Brady's too old. It's that they're doing it in spite of everything that makes it impressive or admirable.
Right. So it's the resistance that kind of makes you stronger. And the more, so sometimes, like, the times that you're born in, like, sometimes I wish, damn it, why couldn't I have been born in, like, the 19th century or in ancient Athens? You know, there's some things about the 2020, that 2021 that I just don't like, you know? I would have been so much happier, but then I have so much to resist against that it almost, is almost like a form of pleasure that I have to, like, struggle even harder to focus on reading. And reading a book now, reading Nietzsche or reading Marcus Aurelius, is triple the pleasure when you live in a world that's so antithetical to it, right?
Not just antithetical, but, like, reading the Stoics during a pandemic, plague, you realize, oh, this is what's happening.
Right.
Stefan Zweig, who I know you love, wrote this amazing biography of Montaigne.
Yeah, I told you about that.
And when you read it and you go, oh, this is a guy writing, he's a refugee from Hitler, writing about a guy who's a refugee from Europe's Civil War.
Yeah.
And then I was reading it in 2016.
Right.
And you're just getting, you just sort of realize it's all, and Marx Rios talks about this in Meditation, it's always been this way.
Yeah.
People are people.
Yeah.
This is the rhythms of history. Insane things happen, unjust things happen.
Yeah.
And it comes back to the fundamental question that Zweig says in that book, and that I think he says was Montaigne's primary question, which is, how do you find freedom despite the constraints or difficulties or chaos of the world around you?
Montaigne was a great lover of the Stoics, and
he had a quote of Epictetus on his
on
the ceiling in his library.
Yeah, he was amazing. He was so far ahead of his time in so many ways, because he was appalled at the treatment in the colonization of Brazil, etc., of the treatment of slavery, etc., and he was kind of saying that the cannibals were more ethical than the Europeans of his time, etc. He was amazing. People like that who were outside of their time.
He loved cats.
He loved cats. Well, there you go. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, that's true. Maybe that's a good place to stop, because you were describing your near-death experience earlier. And I was thinking of Montaigne's near-death experience. He falls off this horse.
Yeah, yeah.
By the way, his brother died. He was hit with a tennis ball.
I don't remember that.
His brother died in a tragic tennis accident, which doesn't seem possible for the 1500s.
Maybe they're covering it up with something.
But it was. Yeah. So he falls off a horse and he dies. And as they carry him into the house, he said he could feel death dancing on the tip of his lip, or life dancing on the tip of his lips, realizing that it was this force inside you that can go away.
Yeah.
And basically all of his work comes after this near-death experience.
Yeah.
And how has your brush with mortality changed
you? Well, it's very true that life is like, so we so intellectualize and verbalize things, but life is a feeling inside your body. It's an energy. It's a force. How could you ever put the words that would describe what it's like?
It's ineffable.
It's ineffable, but you know it when it's like leaving you, what that feeling is like. So there was another woman who she wrote a great book about her stroke called Stroke of Insight, Jill Bolte. She became a neuroscientist. She had a much worse stroke, and she literally felt all of the life draining out of her body inch by inch by inch, as death was passing through her. I had a little bit of that, and I also felt that this kind of force that is being alive is like being drained out of me. It wasn't as strong as that because my stroke wasn't as bad. But I did connect to the feeling of life and the feeling of death, because I had the feeling of death in my body. As I described earlier, the sense of my bones kind of shriveling and melting and getting soft, and kind of everything that makes you alive kind of leaving your body. So it makes you aware that there's a physicality to being alive, to being conscious, and to that you carry your death within you. And I'm writing a little bit now about childhood. And what's interesting is children are actually very much closer to that than we are as adults.
Because they were just born.
2 years ago, 3 years ago, they came out of the womb. They came out of the darkness.
They did not exist.
So they have a feeling of what it means to like not exist, and to have that sudden burst of light and to scream and you're alive. It's kind of a mix of horror and something pleasurable, I suppose. I don't know. But it is true that children have a much more visceral connection to life and death as we do as adults. We lose it because as we get older,
we take the force for granted.
Completely
for granted.
Because we've had
it for however many years you've been alive.
Yeah. So that sense of like dancing on your tongue, that's brilliant. You know, it's like pervading your whole body. It's a feeling that you're being alive. And consciousness itself is a weird sensation. So sometimes when I'm meditating, I almost have this idea that the world itself is conscious, that it exists outside of my brain, that everything in the world has a kind of consciousness to it. But we don't think about these things. We take it for granted that we're this one animal that's able to think, that has a consciousness. So many of the things that we take for granted, it goes back to that Marcus Aurelius thing about the dead pig or the wine that you drink. What does it actually mean to have thoughts, etc.? And so nearly dying kind of brings that stuff home to you.
So understanding that life is a force and that you watched it almost leave, how do you protect it now that you got it back, however briefly? How do you think about that force as you go through your life day to day?
Well, I'm very aware of it. I'm very aware of the precariousness of it. You know, I'm very aware of the fact that it could leave me at any moment. So just the awareness is kind of something that makes you feel a little bit more alive. It's, you know, so the other thing is in writing this book on the sublime and kind of studying the history of evolution and how certain things evolve, like the eye and emotions and the skeleton, etc., it makes you look at your own body in a completely different way. It's like this insane miracle. So life almost seems like it shouldn't be there. It's uncanny.
It's absurd.
It's absurd, you know? And so I have a lot of kind of surreal moments where I almost feel like I'm taken out of my body a little bit. As I was saying earlier, it was just for a flash, but I was watching a squirrel climb up the telephone pole, and I was kind of feeling what it was like to be a squirrel. I do that often in my backyard. I watch squirrels. I'm kind of fascinated by them, and I think
they seem like they're having a good time.
Oh, they seem like they're in paradise, continual paradise. There are trees everywhere. There are nuts everywhere. There are fruit plants in my backyard that they're decimating.
The thing I heard about squirrels is they lose like 40 or 50% of the nuts that they hide. But yeah. but in so doing create the forest that we then really? Love. Right. Oh. So it's like the accidental absurdity of their, like the byproduct of their stupidity could be that tree.
Well, right, I would, hey, wait a minute. I wouldn't call squirrels stupid because they've shown they have incredible memory.
But clearly not that great if they lose 50% of the nuts that they have.
Now it's going up to 50%. I heard that they have these certain kind of things in their brain where they can remember exactly where they buried that nut in the pot in your backyard, but I could be wrong.
You get my, but yeah. Yes, I agree. They seem like they're having a good time.
They're always having a good time, yeah. So sometimes I just have flashes of how weird life is. They're only like for a second or two, but they're.
That's how kids think too, I think.
Yeah.
They love that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, hopefully you'll have many, many more of them.
Kids?
No, of those moments, of those moments. If life is fleeting, I think that's also one reason to soak in whatever the moment is, even if it's banal or strange or, you know, we want to see the Grand Canyon, to go what we're talking about, but then we ignore the slightly harder beauty of the squirrel, which is a lot more prevalent and accessible at any moment.
Or just take 5 minutes to watch a spider on a web. I did that in my backyard the other day. Oh, man, it's like better than any movie you could watch streaming on Netflix. Just sit there and watch a spider on a web it's created, just waiting there as the wind kind of, and how it feels every single vibration. I mean, it's just everywhere around you, little weird things like that. You know, I hope I don't sound like Pollyannish or like some of you writes for Reader's Digest or something.
I don't think anyone has ever accused Robert Greene of sounding Pollyannish.
Okay.
No, this is amazing. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you very much, Ryan.
Hey, it's Ryan. Thank you for listening to the Daily Stoic podcast. I just wanted to say we so appreciate it. We love serving you. It's amazing to us that over 30 million people have downloaded these episodes in the couple years we've been doing it. It's an honor. Please spread the word, tell people about it. And this isn't to sell anything. I just wanted to say thank you. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to the best one yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to the best one yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.